You are listening to Find Your Flow in MoCo, part of the Destination Marketing Podcast Network. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Find Your Flow in MoCo. I'm your co-host, Natasha Lai.
And I'm your other host, Danielle Gibson. Today, we are joined by Caroline Swope. She has been with the City of Decatur for a little over 3 years now. She is extremely specialized in her expertise. We are absolutely thrilled to have her with us today. She's going to be sharing with us a little more about historic preservation and why Decatur is so unique in its architecture. Caroline is not a native to the City of Decatur, but she chose to move here because of Decatur's unique aspects. So thanks for being here with us today, Caroline.
You are welcome.
We're very excited to have you and to get to hear from you. Before we jump in, though, we do have to do our cheese straw segment.
And today's description is provided by Don Dukemanier.
All right. Awesome, Don. We're excited to have you explain what a cheese straw is. So why don't you go ahead and share your definition with us?
So I guess to explain my definition of what a cheese straw is, I have to go back to some of the memories of my childhood. My grandmother was the head of several of the cafeterias for the city school systems here. And she always made everything from scratch during the holiday, especially around Christmas time. And especially with the desserts, she would make divinity, cheese straws, a lot of different things. And I'm really not sure what all went into it. I just took part in eating it. That was always the best part for me. And so cheese straws to me was kind of like a little bit of some dough with a lot of flour and butter, kind of divided up and put in the oven for a little bit and enjoy a little bit of some cheese if you want to put certain types on it. But at the end of the day, it's always a good dessert and always able to enjoy those last little minute sugar rushes a little bit.
Okay. So would you say it's more sweet or more savory?
For cheese straws, I'd say it's probably more savory than sweet. But I have known people to be able to add a little bit of some sugar on top. So if it fits you well, then whatever suits you to make it more enjoyable.
Awesome. We always love hearing the cheese straw segments. They kind of make my day. But now we're going to learn more about historic Decatur and hear more about Caroline.
So Caroline, you have such an interesting background. So could you please tell us just a little bit more about you?
So I am an architectural historian, and I have a background in historic preservation, Main Street, and community development.
So why did you choose Decatur to live and to work?
Decatur has this really fantastic, compact historic core where you can easily reach parks, farmers market, library, shopping, post office, these historic walking neighborhoods that are really enjoyable to be in, and an exceptionally strong commitment to the historic built environment.
So can you kind of tell us a little bit more about your position with the City of Decatur? If I'm not mistaken, that was a newly created position for you. Is that right?
They did. I mean, they'd been a position historically where they had a staff person oversee the historic districts. And at the time I came in, that position was a contract position, and it was part-time by my predecessor. But before them, it had been a full-time position within the city some years ago. So I think it was sort of reevaluating and reinvestigating a position that some municipal leaders felt they needed back and expanding the opportunities. So I serve as the historic preservation specialist. I work within community development. So I assist the city's Historic Preservation Commission, which is what most people are familiar with, and they are a quasi-judicial board. They oversee changes on exterior of buildings and landscaping within the two local historic districts, Albany and Old Decatur. But I also handle a lot of community outreach for them. So the Designing Decatur publication that was distributed last year to all the fourth graders through the schools. And then I manage all of the state and federal preservation grants and assist with the 5 historic city-owned buildings. So buildings like Old State Bank, the Carnegie, the Railroad Depot, the Princess, and the structures within Delano Park. And I assist on historic tax credits for some of the commercial property owners as well.
So a little bit more about the historic tax credits. That is an opportunity to really help revitalize the downtown and kind of the surrounding areas. So I know that you play a crucial role in helping those developments might have not happened had you not been there to assist them with. I know there are a lot of rules and guidelines that they have to follow, and you're there to assist them with that. So do you want to talk a little bit about your education though? Because you have quite an extensive amount of education that, you know, you bring to the table. Every time I talk to you, I'm like, this is like the most amazing woman ever.
So I do. I started working in preservation in the 1980s. I used to always be the youngest person in the room. I can't say that anymore. I passed that quite some time ago. So I have the practical experience, the field experience, but then I also have advanced degrees in it. So my undergraduate degrees are majors were history, art history, and interior design. As I started moving through that process, I discovered I really liked the building portion of art history. I really kept focusing back on buildings. And, you know, this was in the 80s. It's not like you could really go to the computer and just Google stuff. So if you didn't have direct experience with it in your life, you probably weren't aware of it. Or if your guidance counselors didn't know of it, you weren't going to be aware of it. And I stumbled into historic preservation for a master's. So I have a master's in historic preservation. And I kept coming back to, I wanted more data. When I did just field projects, I felt like I was missing the research end. And I felt like I was missing a lot. So then I ended up getting a doctorate specializing in architectural history. And I've lived in various areas of the country. So I'm from Virginia. And I love my home state very much, but I did decide to go to school for my undergraduate in North Carolina because I wanted to see a different area of the South. It was just close enough. It was 3 hours away. I could still get home on the weekends for laundry runs. And then for my master's, I was like, okay, it's time to see a different region of the country. And I went to the Midwest, spent 2 years there. Not a best friend with cold, I have to admit. I actually had a doctoral application mostly finished to University of Minnesota. And then I went through one of those really cold Indiana winters and thought, there is no way on God's green earth I can handle this temperature for eight more years. Like, can't do it. And then I ended up for the doctorate at University of Washington in Seattle, a little more temperate and a different region of the country. So it was really interesting to see architectural trends and how they're actually fairly similar, which is something sometimes people don't realize, and how each region has its own sort of dialect architecturally as well. So it's a lot of fun.
I love that. You're very accomplished too with all of that. So that's amazing.
I'm really lucky that my job is what I do in my free time. Now, my family might say otherwise, because I think sometimes vacations with me are like the Bataan death march of architectural identification. So like my toddler, even by age 3, he could, when he was with the babysitter in the stroller, he'd pass certain houses like, purple house, mommy don't like. You know? So he knew, because I was very vocal and this is working and this isn't working. But I love what I do.
So I think what's interesting is, you know, we've got the two historic downtowns, and then we also have Old Decatur in Albany. And I think, you know, to your normal person who doesn't know about all this historic preservation, what Caroline helps facilitate is that you can't just use whatever materials that you want to use. Like, it's got to be, you know, specific guidelines. So Caroline, do you want to talk a little bit about our two historic downtowns and then the Old Decatur in Albany?
Sure. So I'll start first. This is actually my introduction to Decatur, which was like in 2004. So pre-GIS, got a printed paper map of the state. Amazing. We had come out here to look at Huntsville. We were looking at about a 30-mile commute radius from Huntsville. Decatur was one of the municipalities we looked at. And I didn't know it at the time, but we had ended up in Old Decatur and had gone down like Canal Street and Oak Street and thought, oh, wow, this is really nice. Passed a few houses, thought, okay, I kind of live in this house if this was for sale. And then just a few minutes later, we found ourselves on Second. Now, you have to understand, when you have a big state map, it's not going to differentiate Decatur. It's just a little dot and everything's Decatur. So I sort of stopped. I was like, wait, we're in a different city. How? No. Wait, did we cross the river? We didn't cross the river again, did we? We came over the river to get here, but we're not where we were. And now I'm confused. I just remember like unfolding the map and trying to work it through the car and being completely confused and had no clue where I was at that point. So that was my first introduction to Decatur has two downtowns. Decatur was originally two separate municipalities. And what we now think of as Old Decatur and Old Town East and Old Town West and Bank Street, that was the original location of the community. It was first known as Rhodes Ferry Landing because there was a ferry landing that crossed the river. And it was strategically a very important location. It was the eastern terminus of the Tuscumbia-Cortland and Decatur Railroad. This is the first railroad west of the Appalachian Mountains. And during the Civil War, it was such a strategic location that pretty much all but four buildings were removed by the Union. They pretty much razed that portion of the city. So when, after the war, Old Decatur rebuilt, Old Town East and West rebuilt, and most of the buildings, with the exception of like Old State Bank and a couple of their iconic buildings, are post-Civil War there. And it has their own sort of main street, their own downtown, that's Bank Street. After the Civil War, a group of Northern and Southern businessmen incorporated what they called the Decatur Land Improvement and Furnace Company. And they purchased over 5,000 acres of land southeast of Decatur. Now, at the time it was southeast of Decatur, now it would be right up against Decatur because, you know, municipalities grow. And they developed Delano Park. So what we think of as the Albany District, Second Avenue, that commercial main street, that is part of what was originally called New Decatur. So we had two separate municipalities here. They did not merge until the early 20th century. So you have to imagine two separate town halls, two separate taxing structures, two separate mayors, all of it. And that's where these two very distinct historic neighborhoods sort of come from. And that's why the commercial streets in each look somewhat different and separate, even though they're really close. I mean, you can walk from one to the next.
That's so cool. Also, I was like mesmerized just listening to you explain all of this. I was like, wow.
And also in that area is, and I know this is a project also that Caroline is currently working on. We've tried to distinguish with wayfinding signage the different districts and, you know, kind of tell the story because it's so intriguing, like you said, and interesting how it all evolved.
It is. And it can be confusing for people because we have other historic districts as well and the way they have been split. So if you look at the National Register districts, we had Bank Street was its own district, and then we had Old Decatur, the residential. And then about 1985, they merged the two to make one National Register district. Then on the other side of the railroad tracks, just right behind Bank Street, we have Old Town East and Old Town West, two additional National Register districts. That entire geographic region functioned as one commercial and residential downtown originally. But they're just represented by different National Register districts, essentially different sets of paperwork. I like to think of it as a book in multiple volumes is sort of the best way to think about it. Then when Albany formed and they created the National Register districts for Albany, it's in two separate National Register districts. One is residential only, and those boundaries are, you know, the residential portions by Delano Park. And the other is commercial only, and that's predominantly Second Avenue. So that gives us five National Register districts, even though people might only think of historically Old Decatur and Albany.
And as you walk through, the architecture is so different from one house to the other. One of the popular ones is what we call the gingerbread house. Caroline, I know that's not the correct word for it, but that's literally what it looks like. It's one of the iconic homes. But what's neat as you walk through there is that most of the homes have signage in front of them that give the name and then the year in which they were built. So that's also pretty neat.
It is. It's really nice to see. And you can actually track land development usage by looking at the different styles. So if you walk through either of the local historic districts, and even though we have five National Register districts, we only have two local historic districts that get design review, Old Decatur Residential and Albany Residential. And when you walk through those, you'll see these really ornate Victorians, these Queen Anne's, which is what people will call the gingerbread house, because they just look like someone took piping tube full of icing and just went to town to decorate them almost like a wedding cake. And they're very ornate. And those are typically 1880s to 1900s. But then you can also see infill. So if you walk through a neighborhood and you're on a street that maybe has three or four pretty nice Victorians, and then all of a sudden you go to a couple craftsmen, which are typically built 20, maybe even 30 years later, that's telling you, oh, they had vacant lots, most likely. Sometimes you get fires, but they could have had vacant lots. They could have subdivided bigger lots. Maybe somebody wanted their child to have a house. Sometimes you'll see that, where they start building for children 10, 20, 30 years later. And then as you get to the edges, particularly in Albany, you start seeing more 1920s and even into the 40s development. So you'll see all slew of these really fabulous Dutch colonials. And then you start seeing a little bit of that mid-century modern as those brick sort of small, we call them ranchettes because they're not really full-scale ranch houses, are being put in. And so it's almost like going in a time machine as you walk down the blocks and you can start to see how the infill and the patterns went. And it's really fun to look at the buildings.
And really, we see the downtown area change vastly, and I think we'll even see it change a lot more in the next couple of years. So I know that you, with working with developers, there has been some public announcements that maybe you can talk about, and I know there's some on the horizon that maybe you can't talk about. But the ones that you can talk about, would you like to kind of highlight those?
Sure. So with the School of the Arts, they've obviously, we're looking at putting in dormitories there. We've got a parking deck coming online to address downtown parking. We are looking at a developer bringing in a downtown hotel, which is going to be catty corner from Mellow Mushroom. All of these things are sort of in different development stages. And that's specifically very much the Second Avenue Albany district. That's what's occurring there right now. I have one or two tax credit projects in that neighborhood as well, and I can circle back in a minute and fill you in on what a tax credit is a little bit. Then on Bank Street, sort of the big development, we have infill going in behind the archive building. It's going to be townhomes back in there. We have the tower building coming online as a historic tax credit project, and there's a handful of other tax credit projects in that neighborhood as well that we're working on. So historic tax credits, if you have a National Registered District and your building is listed as a contributing building within that district, or if you are a standalone building maybe outside the district, but you have enough architectural integrity to still really show off the period that you were built in and why you're a really good example of a style, then you can be eligible for a federal and or state historic tax rehabilitation credits. The federal program has been around since the 70s, if I remember correctly. And when you're eligible because your building is important enough that keeping it architecturally intact and historically intact is telling the story of your community, that that building, that neighborhood is important. So to get the federal funds for this on that tax credit, you don't get money because your building is an old building. You're getting money because you are preserving what makes your building unique and old. So you really are focusing on keeping the original finishes and materials. And there's recognition that doing that often costs more because you're using much more highly skilled labor. It takes a lot more out of the labor pool to get someone who's skilled enough to put together a damaged plaster wall versus someone just throwing up new construction that can occur very quickly with unskilled labor sometimes. So the tax credit, it's a recognition of preserving these places that matter costs more. So we're going to help assist you in that. They're fairly lengthy applications. There are three parts. The first part is the building eligible? And you have to prove your case. And you can say, well, wait a second, my building's been in the National Register on this site for 30 years. Of course it's eligible. That's essentially having a 30-year-old doctor's note. They want a more recent doctor's note. You have almost think of it as like a checkup. So you have to have someone that meets certain professional qualifications to go in and say, I've examined the building. This is how I'm going to make the case that it is still eligible for this program. That is something that I can assist with because I have those qualifications and I have the experience doing it. Then part two is, okay, this is what the building looks like now. This is everything we want to do to it. And it has to meet very specific federal guidelines. You don't get to say, well, gee, I'm going to rip out all the lath and plaster and I'm going to, you know, put an addition on the back and pop in some skylights. And that's probably not going to pass. They want to see very distinct phrasing saying, yes, this wall is a plaster wall. We are going to add new electrical. This is how it's going to be done. And then the third stage is when you bring in the accountants. I don't deal with the third stage. Nobody wants me anywhere near math equations. But they make sure that everything meets. They bring in appraisers. They bring in accountants to check the receipts. And they do resubmit photographs, basically taken from the exact same vantage point, saying, okay, this is what it looked like when construction started. There's a reminder of what we said we were going to do. And here's a picture showing what we've actually done. And if the review committee at the federal or state level looks at it and says, well, wait a second, you said you're going to do 10 things. You did 9 of them beautifully. The 10th, you did not follow what you were supposed to. you have a choice. You either fix it and bring it back into compliance, or you risk losing your access to the program. So they're pretty strict on it, but they're really fabulous programs. They bring a lot of resources back into the community. The last time I ran the math, we were looking at close to $8 million. I think it was like $7.5 million in authorized projects, with right around $3.5 or $4 million in federal and state money going into those projects. So the federal tax credit is 20 cents on the dollar. There is a state tax credit program that's very, very similar to the federal one. It is 25 cents on the dollar. When you stack the two, you can get potentially 45% of your construction, approved construction budget covered by this project. And it's a fabulous development tool. And it's one that a lot of communities don't seem to be that aware of, even though it's been in existence for, you know, over 40 years. And the first one of these I did was in the early 90s. So they're great. They really are. And they breathe a lot of life back into the historic buildings that tell your story.
Wow, that's really incredible.
Yeah, it's exciting for residents and for visitors, because we're going to see hopefully some new restaurants and a market and a hotel downtown, which we have one that's close to downtown, but that's not within walking distance of our attractions. So it's going to create a really great experience. So we're thankful for Caroline and all the work that she's doing to make a lot of these projects happen, to create unique experiences for guests. So a lot of what we talked about today is also in a brochure form with a walking tour. So that's available both in a podcast and a brochure form. So that is available on our website. So you can check all of this out that we've talked about today. And then kind of moving into that, during the April timeframe, we have the April walking tours. So Natasha, let's talk a little bit about the walking tours.
Let's do it. So I know that the walking tours involve the whole state of Alabama, but you have a couple that are located specifically in Decatur. How many of them generally are in Decatur versus the whole state?
Sure. So the Alabama Tourism Department does this every April. So this is kind of an initiative by the state. So there's typically about 20 cities that participate, and it's every Saturday morning, typically around 10 a.m. Sometimes that can vary, but it's four times a month, the four Saturdays of the month at 10 o'clock. And we don't know yet, just depending on how the times go, we could be doing this either digitally or in person. So you can find out that information on both Decatur Parks and Rec, most likely the Old State Bank, and then also our site. And then also, if they either way, it'll also be information on the Alabama Tourism Department site. So the past couple of years, we've not been able to do them in person. So on our YouTube, we also have those walking tours available at any time. So we'll be creating new ones if it does come to that, but there are existing ones currently on our YouTube. So I did want to ask Caroline, since she's here with us, Caroline, what is one of your favorite historic tours? I bet I can guess, but I'm going to let you tell us.
You know, we've had a couple in past years. David Breland and I joined forces, and we one year did one in Old Decatur, another year when we did one in Albany, where we would tag team. So I would cover the architectural history, and then he would cover all sort of the social history and the stories behind the buildings. Those were a lot of fun. And I've done some where I focus more on changes on the buildings. I had a colleague once refer to it as CSI for buildings, because you sort of walk through them and, okay, we're going to decipher what someone did to this building and what did it used to look like and how can you see the built environment with that lens. And so those can be fun too. This year, we've got a couple different ones we've been talking about. We're sort of still in the planning stages. Once we know what we're producing, in addition to sending it your way, Danielle, we'll also put it on the Decatur, Alabama Historic Preservation Commission Facebook page, so people will know what's up and coming.
Awesome. So I know that you've had the old ones on YouTube and everything, and that they're on the Saturdays, but how can people participate in them, or like where will they find more information so that they can, you know, go on these walking tours?
Sure. So we will have it listed kind of all over our social channels, but then we'll also have it on our events calendar on our website, DecaturCVB.org. So that's really going to be kind of the base of where you can find all of the information. And of course, we'll definitely share off of what Caroline shares. So it will be correct information when we're ready to post what exactly the tours will be this time.
Perfect. And can people go on these tours at other times of the year? Because I know it's a big push during April, but I'm curious if it's still available at other times.
Sure. So it may not be those specific tours, because those are kind of specialized. Caroline and Judge Berlin get together and they make these kind of specialized tours. But we do have historic tours that are available all throughout the year in brochure form. So whichever part of town that you want to tour, we most likely have a brochure that's available. And most of them also have some sort of podcast. You know, if you prefer not to look at a map, you can also find it on our podcast.
Very cool.
So while we've got Caroline here, I thought May is Historic Preservation Month. So Caroline, do you want to tell us what that means?
Sure. National Historic Preservation Month is actually an extension of what used to be National Historic Preservation Week. And that was signed into law by President Nixon in 1973. So after decades of having Preservation Week, in 2005, the National Trust for Historic Preservation reached out to its partners and said, why don't we make it a whole month of celebration? So at the national level in May, you will see lots of extra walking tours, lots of additional podcasts, activities. A lot of communities will do preservation awards during that time, sometimes banquets, fundraisers. And for Decatur, typically the mayor will give a proclamation declaring May as Historic Preservation Month. The Historic Preservation Commission will honor homeowners, volunteers, organizations who've worked hard to maintain Decatur's historic character. That's typically the way that we celebrate.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Caroline. I'm so excited to have you on our podcast with us today. It's always fun getting to talk about the wonderful history and events that make Decatur and Morgan County what it is.
You are welcome. It is a fabulous sitting with this really great architectural tapestry to sort of move through.
I have to second everything Danielle said. I feel like I learned so much from you just sitting here listening, and it was very clear how passionate and how much you love these buildings and all these things that you work with every day. So I'm very grateful that we got to have you on here.
Thank you.
Of course. Now, before we finish up, Danielle, are there any little teasers or highlights that you want to share before we wrap up?
Sure. So on our upcoming podcast, we have some very special guests that are going to be joining us. We are going to have Mike Hall, who is the athletic director of SSAC, and they will be hosting their championship here. And then we've got a great lineup for all the way through the summer to talk about Point Mallard Water Park and lots of different things. So you're going to want to make sure to tune in with us.
Definitely. Lots of great content coming your guys' way. Thank you all for being here with us, and make sure that you check out those walking tours and, you know, just explore those amazing historic downtowns when you get the chance.
And you can always find us at Visit Decatur AL on Instagram, Facebook, or TikTok, or you can also visit our website at DecaturCVB.org.
Awesome. Thank you everyone for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe or leave a review. This has been Find Your Flow in MoCo. Thanks for listening to Find Your Flow in MoCo, part of the Destination Marketing Podcast Network. Hosted by Natasha Lai and Danielle Gibson, produced by Relic.